A Philosophic Consideration of Man 395. 396 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. Arc: the life waves gathered into groups by certain common motives which cause similar nature to incline toward catch other, moving in a circle as it were about the central life. These herds are represented in mythology by Ixion bound to the will of generation as the dispenser of sleep and oblivion. Ion, Hermes controls the moods by which men are entangled and held to form, or rather released therefrom. It is Hermes also who governs the memories and closes the doors of the past for those as yet not rationally awakened, and therefore unfit to contemplate the record of past actions. He is likewise denominated the supplier of recollections, and in this office is true to his great role of universal instructor. As the god of wisdom, Hermes instructs men by revealing to each individual the record of his own experiences. In the Egyptian myths, Hermes is the scribe of the gods, and his writings are traced upon the tables of memory. With a gesture, Hermes veils these records from the uninitiated, but reveals them to such as have awakened their inner consciousness. On the widespread acceptance of the doctrine of metempsychosis among the ancients, Godfrey Higgins in 1836 wrote, "It was held by the Pharisees, or Persas, as they ought to be called, among the Jews, and among the Christians by Origen. Chalcidius, if he were a Christian, signed Sus, and by the Simonians, Basilidians, Valentinians, Marcionites, and the Gnostics in general." *#* Thus this doctrine was believed by nearly all the great and good of nearly every religion and of every nation and age, and though the present race has not the smallest information more than its ancestors on this subject, yet the doctrine has not now a single votary in the western part of the world. The theory of reincarnation was frequently employed by ancient historians and philosophers in the interpretation of their fables. Plutarch declares the account of Bacchus being attacked and dismembered by the Titans to be a sacred narrative concerning reincarnation, while Sallust, in the Gods of the World, explains the rape of Persephone as an ancient allegory signifying the descent of the soul into birth. Several Greeks declared themselves to be aware of the previous bodies which their generating soul had precipitated into material existence. Pythagoras discourses at some length on his previous lives, and the description of five of these will be found in my large book on symbolism. Empedocles also remembered when his rational soul had occupied the body of a young girl. The Emperor Julian believed his soul to have manifested in a former life as Alexander the Great, and Proclus, according to Marinus, unhesitatingly declared that his rational nature had achieved its high dignity while in the body of Nicomachus, the Pythagorean. It should be particularly noted that, unlike the present popular concept of reincarnation, the ancients did not affirm themselves to have been some other person in a previous life, but rather that the rational principle dwelling in them had previously dwelt in other forms. Plotinus writes, "It is a universally admitted belief that the soul commits sins, expiates them, undergoes punishment in the invisible world, and passes into new bodies." He might also have added that it was a universally admitted belief that the mysteries, by assisting the rational soul in its procedures, shorten the number of reincarnations and release the inner nature to return to the felicity of its father star. Here, then, we have the whole purpose of the mysteries, which existed as institutions of liberation, serving the invisible part of man, and surviving only in civilizations where the rational nature was regarded as worthy of culture and education. Plato also affirms that when the soul fails to achieve liberation and willfully follows perversity, it passes into the body of a woman. This enigmatic statement is generally interpreted to signify that the soul takes up its residence in the matrix awaiting rebirth. In the profundities of Platonic philosophy, however, a truth far more recondite was inferred. General Pleasanton discovered that when man degenerates himself through vice of excess, his whole constitution is electrically repolarized and electrically, he becomes a woman. This does not mean that women are degenerate men, but rather that man in a virtuous state is negative in his vital or etheric body, while woman. A philosophic consideration of man 397. 398 lectures on Ancient philosophy is positive. When through excessive emphasis of physical propensities and sensibilities man moves his center of consciousness into his physical nature, the latter is rendered positive and therefore technically feminine, although its manifestations are totally dissimilar to the natural feminine organism, which is positive by divine decree. Why do we persist in accusing the ancients of ridiculous fancies when our own generation has proved conclusively the correctness of their deductions? There is but one answer: we have arrived at our findings through what are termed scientific means or procedures, and hence are foolish enough to presume that they could not possibly have been discovered in any other way. In reality, philosophy armed only with the instruments of reason has penetrated the rational sphere where science fears to tread, and has left a record of glorious accomplishment in every division of learning. One other thought before we pass to the consideration of another phase of man's philosophic constitution, namely, the incarnation of deeds and the buildings of bodies composed of actions. Plato has already affirmed that man as a form proceed from the sensations. It is equally important to bear in mind that all thought, feeling, and action, having their origin in the superphysical nature, descend like monads from their generating sphere, and clothing themselves in appropriate vehicles manifest as entities upon the planes of the inferior universe. In a symbolical sense, insects were regarded by the ancients as the incarnations of human attitudes. Butterflies, for example, were said to be an expression of the beautiful thoughts of men, while evil insects that torment man and beast were the offspring of destructive impulses of the soul. Plagues were attributed to a similar origin, for the bacillus, coccus, and spirillum, now die subject of so much scientific disputation, were regarded simply as minute organisms enlivened by the various emotions of men. In the invisible world, therefore, exist manifold orders of life that are actually the mental and emotional progeny of human beings. Paracelsus recognized this fact when he describes the incubus and the succubus, the demons, male and female respectively, fashioned from the stuff of emotional intemperance. Man may yet come to realize that he possesses the power to create living things, and in great measure thus fashion the instruments for his own torment. When Christian theologians substituted hell for the pagan will of existence, they evidently sensed the import of Plato's intimation that physical existence was the death of the spirit. The material universe, in whose substances our emotions find vehicles of expression and our actions forge weapons to cause us suffering, is indeed a sphere of recompense, a world of retribution, a place of punishment wherein nature's perforce must linger until their own innate perversity has been mastered. In the Sefer HaZohar attributed to Rabbi Simeon ben Jochai it is written, "Woe to the man who says that the doctrine delivers common stories and daily words. For if this were so, then we also in our time could compose a doctrine in daily words which would deserve far more praise. If it delivered usual words, then we should only have to follow the lawgivers of the earth, among whom we find far loftier words, to be able to compose a doctrine. Therefore we must believe that every word of the doctrine contains in it a loftier sense and a higher mystery. The narratives of the doctrine are its cloak. Woe to him who takes the covering for the doctrine itself. The simple look only at the garment, that is, upon the narratives of the doctrine, more they know not. The instructed, initiated, however, see not merely the cloak, but what the cloak covers. As the written law, thus likened to a garment, conceals within it that unwritten law which is the first mystery, so must the body of man be regarded as a vestment within which a most hidden doctrine is preserved. Moralizing upon the issues of Scripture, theology fails utterly to comprehend the hidden meaning of the sacred books. It cannot conceive of Scriptures as writings concerned with philosophic anatomy, yet such is necessarily the case, for the regeneration by which man's salva, aphilosophiccons iteration ofman 399. 400 lecturesonancientphilosophy. Shin is wrought must take place within his own constitution. To this mystery Socrates alludes when in the first Alcibiades he observes that when the soul enters into herself she will behold all other things. Proclus further adds that when she, the soul, proceeds into her inner recesses and into the adytum of her own nature, she perceives with her eye closed the genus of the gods and the unities of things, the rites and symbols, so carefully preserved against the ravages of time and unenlightened ages have been saved for such as can realize that the human body itself is the house of hidden places, the tabernacle of the Most High God, the place of the initiation, the sanctum sanctorum where in properly consecrated chambers the deities abide and accept the sacrifices offered up by sensible natures. Turning inward from the concerns of the outer life, man enters an area dedicated to the immortals. His own interior constitution is holy ground, and here the gods, so distant from his material concerns, mingle their personalities with his aura. Endeavors. Man indeed may be likened to some highly glorified snail carrying his own refuge with him, and in moments of danger retiring into that stronghold which is his real self. The analogies between the house of God in the world and the house of God in the soul have been very carefully drawn. To those unfamiliar with the concept, the likeness is unsuspected. But the moment the mind ponders the problem, the analogy becomes obvious. The secrets of the mysteries have always been safe from the profane because the average individual applies the principles of ancient philosophy to every thing except himself. The modern student of rounds and races, for example, while dividing the whole social order into numberless subdivisions, never applies the principle to the inner part of his own being. The gods are in the heavens, and their power is felt to the most distant parts of the earth. Yet man has not discovered that, most important of all, they are sitting upon their golden thrones within his own nature. There is a reason why the ancient temples were patterned after the human body and why every ritual finds its course